On finance and revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. Let us get out some work before we start our panels. We're introducing bills for the coming session. And Senator Boquist, do you have a motion?
No, because we're not in work session yet, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'll go into work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that LC 953, 1392, 2280, 2282, 2283, 2284, 2285, 2288, 2289, 2291, 2315, 2317, 2318, 2319, 2320, 2321, 2322, 2323, 2324, 2412, 2413, 2414, 2415, 2416, 2419, 2421, 2423, 2424, 2425, 2426, 2427, 2429, 2656, and 3161 is reflected on all must be introduced as a committee bill, and I will speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves the pre-stated list of bills be introduced as committee bills. Senator Boquist, to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we all know, this is not a reflection of support or opposition by any member of the committee. It's simply an introduction of the bills that may be considered before this committee and debated publicly at a later time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Seeing none, these bills will be introduced as committee bills. And that brings us to Senator Edwards. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Our tax expenditure report, so if I could call up John Hart and Tim Fitzgerald from the Department of Revenue, please, to walk us through the new tax expenditure report.
Same slides that were there yesterday, right?
Yes.
Chair House, members of the committee, my name is Tim Fitzgerald. I'm an economist with the Department of Revenue Research Section. I'm here with John Hart, a senior economist with the Department of Revenue Research Section. We're here to introduce the...
I'm going to go full screen.
Sorry?
I'm going to go full screen.
Oh.
We're old. Our eyes aren't that aren't good.
Thank you.
Apologies. We're here to introduce the 2017-19 tax expenditure report. This is a biennial update of the tax expenditure report. The report's been required ever since 1995. It has a large number of components that are just requirements as part of it. The statutory authority for each tax expenditure, the purpose that's usually as set by law, or what we can infer based on what it looks like the tax expenditure is trying to accomplish. We try to estimate the loss of tax revenue for each one. That's always a big part of this process, and it's always a big interest to everyone. We try to calculate who benefits from each individual one. This can be a list of people getting a property tax exemption. We try to break it down, for example, by which counties are getting the benefit. For income tax, we try to look at who's getting the benefit by income tax bracket, various kinds of ways that we can break it down to provide more information. We also do an evaluation of the tax expenditure. We don't tend to do these. We actually farm these out to about a couple dozen agencies around the state that provide this information. They try to take a look at it based on if it's associated with their area of expertise, like housing. We'll take a look at housing-related ones, for example. And then the question is, does the tax provision achieve its purpose? Does it actually do what it's trying to do? And then, you know, if it's not, then maybe what needs to be changed about it? The law also requires us to categorize all of these. We break these out into a lot of different categories, and we actually have far more ways of splitting it out than even what's listed in the report. We have spreadsheets and spreadsheets of this kind of stuff available. But we try to break it up by budget program so it's comparable. So, for example, if you want to look at all the things related to education or for community development or health services, that kind of thing, it's all split out that way. And lastly, there's the requirement for recommendations on the expiring tax expenditures. So these are the ones that are sunsetting during 17-19, and they're the governor's recommendation about whether to allow them to sunset or to extend them. So I kind of glossed over this, but what is a tax expenditure? And the law defines this for us, and tax expenditure reports are done throughout the country, and everywhere they're done, they're a little bit different, and it's actually can be tricky to compare them. But for Oregon, it's the definition we have is set by law. And the important part here is, I'm not going to read literally, but it says it exempts from the impact of established taxes. And that phrasing, that structure of it, is actually pretty different from the way a lot of other reports are done. And this has some implications for how we put together the report or how it can be compared to other states. And it's something John's going to talk about a bit when we talk about some of the connections with federal taxable income. But the definition is very broad, and it is intentionally somewhat vague because we want to be as inclusive as possible and provide as much information as possible. The intent of the report, as it was originally established, was so that decision makers would have information about these provisions in a way that was comparable to spending. So that way you would be able to say, this is intended to work on health purposes, it costs this much to the state, is it a program that's worth continuing? And to think of it in the same way you would any other provision. The report itself has 16 chapters this year. There's an additional chapter for...
Can I stop you?
Oh, yes.
On that definition, mm-hmm. one of the bills we just introduced, a committee bill, will change that definition.
Well, Mr. Chair, it'll direct us and with DOR to review it.
Right. So can you elaborate on the purpose there?
This might be one for John, actually. Sorry.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm John Hart, an economist in the research section at the Oregon Department of Revenue. The definition of tax expenditure, I think, worldwide, that includes the United Kingdom and New Zealand and the United States that I've seen, we struggle with how to define what a tax expenditure is. You want the definition to be broad so that you bring things in. But also you want the definition to be useful so that you're not defining things as tax expenditures that kind of don't make sense as policy choices. So one example of where the definition, where we have tax expenditures where the definition might be vague is in our lodging tax. The lodging tax is intended to tax tourism-related lodging. And so there was a statutory change that said we're intending to tax lodging, and then it listed a bunch of exemptions. For instance, hospital stays are listed as exemptions. Now, in the pure letter of the law, the hospital stays are exempt from the tax, and we include them as a tax expenditure in our report. But from a policy standpoint, the tax probably was never intended to apply to hospital stays. And so thinking of that as a tax expenditure is a little bit disconnected from how we would think of, say, most tax credits as tax expenditures.
Okay, that's somewhat helpful.
Chair Haas, I'm
glad it was to you.
Yeah. We're actually pretty interested in the idea of taking a look at that and trying to open it up, so.
Okay, thanks.
So as I was saying, there's 16 chapters. The new one this year is for the marijuana retail sales tax. Because there's an exemption for medical marijuana, that created a new chapter to add to the book since it's exempt from the tax. The income tax program, which is a combination of corporate and personal, we put them together into chapter one because there's so many things that apply to both. You know, a lot of tax credits that you can take that apply to both, or a lot of subtractions that apply to both. And they make up the vast majority of the book. It's about 190 out of 367 in the book are just income tax related. Property tax makes up the next bulk of them with 137, and then there's only about 40 for all of the other tax programs in the state. The numbering system in the book is all broken out to try to give you a way to look at this. So all the 1.4s, for example, are tax credits. All the 2s are property tax related, that kind of thing. We have a number of tables that we provide in the book that kind of provide this information in different ways to look at it. We have it by subject area. We have some tables on our website that provide it by more specific areas. So if you want to look at, for example, all the ones related to agriculture, we list out the several dozen tax expenditures related to agriculture so that way you can kind of look at them in, as my boss likes to say, bite-sized chunks. A little bit easier to get a grip on just a couple dozen as opposed to the hundreds that are literally in the book. And last, I just want to say this. The tax expenditure report is an excellent place to start looking at these provisions, and it's kind of important to say that it's not the end of the discussion, especially on the revenue estimates. We're looking at the whole revenue impact, but it's not the same as, for example, a bill to repeal a tax expenditure and what kind of revenue gain you could get from it. It's the beginning of a way to look at it, and it gives you a very good idea of the order of magnitude. How big are these things? And they're pretty big. So this is a summary of all the tax expenditures. We broke it out for income, property, and then all the others. And you can see that there's, you know, there's over $13 billion in income tax expenditures for the 17-19 biennium from by our estimates. And there's over $10 billion for the property tax. You know, this is a substantial amount that you can take a look at. In terms of the highlights of this, there's a if for those of you familiar with the previous version's report, that table looks a little bit different, and that's because the property tax side of things is substantially smaller than it has been in previous years. We removed a single provision from the book, intangible personal property, as a property tax exemption. As we were discussing with the definition, this has been an ongoing debate about whether or not this was an exemption that and met the definition of a property tax expenditure. This year, we finally decided it really didn't meet the criteria, and so we took it out of the book. It is it's an unbelievably large tax expenditure. If it were a tax expenditure, it was $15.4 billion was our estimate 2 years ago when we took a look at it, and that's 40% of the total revenue estimate for a biennium. It's unbelievably large, but it was it doesn't meet the criteria of the tax expenditures as defined in law. So in terms of the numbers of tax expenditures that change in the year, we have Appendix D at the end of the book that lists out which ones are added to the book this year, which ones have been modified from previous years, and which ones have been dropped from the last book. It's a good way to, if you're looking for a specific one that you're not sure what happened, or if you want to get an idea of how much has changed since we did this report 2 years ago, so all the changes in the 15 and 16 sessions, gives you a way to look at that. I'd say there were 14 new ones that were added, and 6 were removed because they expired or no longer have an impact. But the remainder that were removed were for a variety of reasons, and you have to kind of look at the specific circumstances to follow each one.
I like how you worded that, "we try to explain."
It could be tricky to get into with one sentence to explain the rather complicated nature of this. So a favorite to provide every year is the top 10 tax expenditures for income taxes. 7 of these, the ones are from our connection to federal income taxes, and the 3 that are highlighted are actually Oregon-specific provisions. This gives you an idea that these 10 provisions out of 190 represent more than 2/3 of the revenue impact. They're very large, and you can see they drop off quite substantially. So if you're looking for the size of these tax expenditures, it's a very unequal distribution between them. On the property tax side, it's a similar kind of situation where the top 10 represent 91% of all of the revenue impact that we estimate. State and local property and federal property being the two largest represent nearly half of the total. These revenue estimates and these ideas, it's all to give you an idea of the order of magnitude and how big these are and which ones to look at if you're trying to get an idea of, you know, the cost is associated with it. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to John.
Thank you. So as you know, we are tied to the federal definition of taxable income, and that's a good place to start. To provide more insight to the committee as to how we put the book together and how we kind of frame which tax expenditures are reported in the book. Since this is the second time we're reporting to the committee in this biennium, we thought we could spice it up a little bit with some of the more deeper topics. So some of the implications of being tied to the federal definition of taxable income is that there's a lot of churn at the federal level in federal law on federal provisions that affect taxable income. We're not connected to federal rates. We're not connected to federal credits, at least not directly. They impact our tax through the federal tax subtraction, but we're not directly connected to those. But there's a bunch of provisions called federal tax expenditures that, starting about 15 years ago, we would have dozens of provisions expiring every year or every 2 years, and we didn't know at the end of a cycle if something was actually going to be extended, so we would be reporting some things that weren't reported at the federal level, and at the federal level there were some things that were reported that we weren't reporting. And we kind of tried to smooth all that out, and so sometimes we would hang on to things that were dropped at the federal level if we didn't know why, and we would combine some things into single tax expenditures that were reported separately at the federal level, and we weren't as transparent as could be with that. So we've tried to fix some of that. Also, the reliance on the federal estimates, we use the Federal Joint Committee on Taxation, means that for a lot of the exclusions or a lot of the special accounting treatment that they call tax expenditures, we don't have any other data except their federal estimates. And so we use those federal estimates to make our estimates. We do use Oregon data, where we have independent data for Oregon subtractions, for Oregon credits. We have independent data for the Schedule A itemized deductions. We have the data directly, at least after about a year's delay, when the IRS sends us the schedule information. So we use that where we can, but a lot of times we're relying on JCT estimates. And JCT often will list some things as too small to report. So to increase our transparency, what we've done is we now, in our descriptions of tax expenditures, we specify where we've combined federal provisions into one Oregon tax expenditure. We list provisions that JCT doesn't estimate, either because they're too small or because the JCT says they can't be quantified. And we also, to provide kind of the completest mapping we can, we list specifically the provisions that are federal tax expenditures, like a qualified production activities deduction. We list that we're not connected to that. And so somebody looking at the federal documents and looking at our documents can kind of make a one-to-one map from the federal to ours now. I don't think that was possible in our last edition. So as some examples, on pages 104 and 105 of our multi-paged book, there's 16 bulleted items that the Joint Committee on Taxation lists as de minimis, 24 they list as not quantifiable, and 8 that we specify we are not connected to the federal provision. As an example of provisions that we combine into a single provision, I've included our second tax expenditure in the book, qualified education savings. We roll 3 federal provisions into that one as we report it. So now we do think that if you take the two reports, you can trace them back and forth. And that's one of the places where it's hard to compare state tax expenditure reports, because it's not always clear who's reporting which provisions if they're not specified. Also, for the first time, we've kind of explicitly documented our criteria to identify what a tax expenditure is. We believe this criteria fits with the statutory definition in Oregon law. Other states include more criteria than ours. But we believe, as these criteria list out, that a tax expenditure reduces taxes. That's important because the Joint Committee on Taxation actually lists several provisions that increase taxes as negative tax expenditures. We don't list negative tax expenditures that have kind of a special provision to increase taxes. If a provision is a Oregon tax expenditure tied to through federal law, then we think it's a tax expenditure if it's reported by the Federal Joint Committee on Taxation. If it's listed in Oregon laws, it's a specific reduction of income or a tax after the or a tax credit after tax has been calculated. Filing statuses and tax rates and other kind of mathematical features that apply to every tax expenditure, we don't see, or that apply to every taxpayer, we don't see as tax expenditures. For instance, the standard deduction, we don't see as a tax expenditure. We see that as a kind of a extension of a zero rate bracket. When we figure the impact of itemized deductions, that's we figure that by eliminating the itemized deduction and then putting the standard deduction in as the established tax. A tax expenditure is not a subtraction of ordinary and necessary business expense. So wages and salaries for a business are not a tax expenditure. A tax expenditure is not a reduction in tax that's necessary to avoid double taxation, credits for taxes paid to another state, and a kind of esoteric credit or even deduction called claim of right that allows a credit for taxes that have been previously paid on income that was reported in the period. We don't see those as tax expenditures. And if a provision is in Oregon law, it needs to be reflected on a tax return or tax statement to be a tax expenditure. We have a provision in law called the Oregon Greenlight Labor Rebate, where the taxpayer pays the tax and then some of that gets rebated to them through a separate program. We don't consider that a tax expenditure because it's not accomplished through the tax system, although it has the word tax in it. And also, it's worth noting implicitly, penalty waivers and interest waivers are not tax expenditures. And so the reduction in taxes kind of implies that it's not a penalty reduction. Recently, maybe starting 5 or 10 years ago, we've seen some attempts to use the definition of tax expenditure in ways that assume a certainty that that definition doesn't have. For instance, in 2012, I think there was an initiative petition that would have limited tax expenditures to the amount of tax expenditures to the amount of the general fund. That kind of broad application of the definition can be challenging. The definition used for reporting doesn't have high stakes. If something's not in the book, we can report it some other way. If we include something in the book that shouldn't be in the book, it doesn't have any direct consequences for an individual taxpayer. But if the definition is used more broadly like that, the stakes are much higher. For instance, if we have a provision, and we do, that says any new tax expenditure enacted by the legislature has a 6-year sunset, then whether or not that's a tax expenditure can have a significant impact on a single taxpayer. And also, things like limiting the tax expenditures to the general fund, or we've also seen proposals to limit, to reduce tax expenditures by the same percent as the governor's allotment reduction percent when necessary. That may be impossible for a lot of things that we call tax expenditures. We talked about the kind of disagreement about whether something might be a tax expenditure, like the hospital stays for the lodging tax, but also we have provisions that are prohibited by federal law. We couldn't reduce those or sunset those, and we have provisions that are kind of accounting treatments, like cash accounting. We have small businesses are able to use cash accounting as their basis for figuring their tax, and it would be extremely difficult to ask them to reduce the impact to their taxes of the cash accounting by a certain percent. They'd basically have to figure their taxes twice, once using the method of accounting they use and once using a foreign method of accounting, and then kind of take a weighted average of those two numbers. So just as a caveat, using that definition in other ways does have higher stakes. And with that, we're happy to take any questions.
We're still waiting for the spicy part.
Sorry.
You guys have a hard job to do, and that report is a necessary reading for all of us every session, and we appreciate your work and commitment to it. Any questions on the tax expenditure? Yes, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about some things that can't be rescinded and is there somewhere a list of those which legally could be or legally could not be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, we do have a list of those that we have categorized as prohibited by federal law, mm-hmm. And we have those categorized in the book. I think anything not prohibited by federal law could be changed, but the difficulty is kind of a provision-by-provision look. Oregon credits are the easiest to change and subtractions, and then we could even limit federal deductions. but some of the accounting treatments become very difficult. That's probably the second place where it would be hard to limit. And then anywhere where there's not agreement about whether something actually is a tax expenditure, then its limitation would have to be kind of decided in court.
Chair House, Senator Riley, a good example of that is one of the new provisions that was added was that if a company is from out of state doing contract work in Oregon for the purpose of disaster relief, essentially the tax expenditures that they don't have to file, that is not considered why they are the contract work to fix telephone lines, that kind of thing, is not the basis by which they could be taxed in Oregon. It's not, doesn't create a nexus. I don't know how you take 10% of that, for example.
Right.
And there's a lot of provisions like that. And in general, really the only way to kind of look at how you'd want to approach tax expenditures is to not use the definition tax expenditures. It's to go provision by provision through law. And so we provide tables that have all of the ORS citations for these and the details. But in general, if you want to do anything with tax expenditures, you really have to go, it's actually these 15 provisions in law, and this is the modification to make, is the way you really should approach the question.
Thank you.
Other questions?
No, too early.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. All right, let's take a look at this. Thanks for coming back. You're just in time for your grand bargain bill we're going to look at here. Chris, do you want to come up and look at the schedule rate reduction?
Find another name. It's not grand bargain. Wherever you want.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And I have a few slides here to talk about and give a first look at the impact of the pass-through tax rate reduction policy. It was part of the special session in 2013. It's also known as the Schedule E rate reduction. So just to refresh everybody's memory, while it was passed and enacted in 2013, the fall of 2013, the first year that it took effect was 2015, and we've gotten to the point where we have most of the tax returns in. DOR is still processing those returns, so this information is not final, but I've been working, the research section over at DOR has been able to take some time to kind of jump ahead and look at the tax returns and send over some information that provides a first glimpse at the policy to get a sense of basically how the revenue impact is looking compared to the projected revenue impact. So, just to refresh everybody's memory and make sure we're on the same page, what the policy is and its requirements. Basically, the objective of the policy is to create a more favorable tax rate structure for a certain kind of income. Basically, it's business income earned by taxpayers who are actively involved in their business. And these are basically partnerships, S corporations, and LLCs that could have this income taxed at a lower rate. One important consideration is what the policy is not. It is not intended to benefit passive investment income or rental income. And all just to for some context, the Schedule E that I'll probably refer to here is a federal form, and it contains a variety of kinds of income on the form. It has rental income, it has some of this passive investment income, and it has this non-passive income or the active income that is subject to the preferential tax rate. And one of the challenges in making the estimates back in 2013 was getting at that exact component of income reported on the Schedule E that was related to this active material, this active income by the participants. And that plays out in a few ways, and the last slide will touch base on some of the policy implications for the how the data process worked. But one of the primary requirement is that the taxpayer must materially participate in the business. Now, material participation is defined in IRS, and we tie to that definition. But in a nutshell, the taxpayer must have regular, continuous, and substantial participation in the business. And the actual rules go into hours and the number of businesses in a lot of detail, but that's the concept. And we also have a requirement that the business have at least one full-time employee and that qualifying employees must work at least 1,200 hours in Oregon. And that was to try and focus the policy on income that is derived from Oregon sources as opposed to Oregon taxpayers who might be generating the income outside the state. For tax year 2015, which was the first year for the implementation of the policy, here's a comparison of the tax rates. So our normal rate structure I have here for the joint income tax rates, our normal four bracket structure, we have our 5, 7, 9, and 9.9% brackets. The brackets for single filers are just half those amounts. So for example here, once a joint filer hit $250,000 of taxable income, their income is taxed at 9%, and then income above $250,000, that income is taxed at 9.9%. The non-passive income tax rates, we have a 5 or 6 bracket structure with a rate as low as 7%. So for this non-passive income, the first $250,000 of that income is taxed at 7%. And this is the net business income. It's after all of the business deductions and so forth. It's that bottom line taxable number. So the first $250,000 is taxed at 7%. The next $250,000 is taxed at 7.2% and so forth, up until $5 million. And for non-passive income above $5 million, the tax rates merge and the tax benefit ceases to increase. So there is a cap per taxpayer per return to the amount of the tax cut. And the merging point is the $5 million of in income. And in a very gross way, here's a diagram of the calculation. And the policy is an opt-in policy, so the taxpayer has to actively decide, yes, I want to take advantage of this policy. So the basic approach or the normal approach for taxpayers is they total up their income, they subtract their deductions, these are the Schedule A deductions, multiplied by the regular rates, the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9, and then they get their gross tax. And then credits come after this. To take advantage of this policy, they have to opt in and they have to declare that they're going to use the policy. And here's where it gets a little more complicated and tax gets calculated twice. The non-passive income is subject to those new rates, the 7 to the 9%. And that will be a gross tax, what I've called here B.1. All of their other income is in a separate bin, and that gets totaled up, and then they subtract their deductions, their Schedule A deductions from that income. And then that net income gets applied to the regular rates, the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9, to come up with a gross tax B.2 that I've called here. Then their actual gross tax is the sum of those two numbers. So one of the important levers here for taxpayers when they consider whether or not they want to use this is whether or not they have other income that can be used for their deductions, because if their only source of income is this non-passive income, taking advantage of the rates means they lose their Schedule A deductions. So that was part of the policy discussion and one of the decision points for the taxpayers. And so presumably at the end of the day, they will choose the lesser of gross tax A or gross tax B, and then that'll be their gross tax, and then they'll get credits against that tax. So the revenue impacts that I estimated back in 2013 are right here. There was a little bit in the 13-15 biennium, and this was just a piece of taxpayers who fully expected to take advantage of the policy. So once tax year 2015 hit, that last 6 months of the 13-15 biennium, they might have lowered their payments. But the bulk of the impact started in this biennium at about $200 million, and by 21-23, the projection was that it increased to about $330 million. So the really new information is right here on these two tables. This is information that the research section at Revenue was able to send over by taking a preliminary look at the 2015 returns. So some of the key numbers here, for tax year 2015, the estimated impact was $91 million revenue loss. Now this $91 million right here is part of the $38 million here it is the $38 million here and the $205 million here. It's spread out over two biennia. The actual impact we've seen is about $66 million. So it's only about 73% of the total impact so far. And so that's about a $25 million difference. And we have heard some anecdotal stories of taxpayers who were unable to take advantage of this because either they didn't know about it ahead of time, and you heard some testimony from the CPAs about some of the technical issues with the policy. As it is an irrevocable choice in a given tax year. So for a given tax year, once a taxpayer chooses to take advantage of the policy or not, an amended return can't change that after the filing deadline. They can, it's not irrevocable over time. Every year they can choose to take it or not. But within a year it is irrevocable. So we know that there was some demand for this outside of it. Whether or not that would account for the $25 million, it's impossible to say because we don't have any quantifiable information on it, although I'm not sure it would hit the full $25 million. So the distribution here is also a significant difference. So at first look here, the estimated, even for taxpayers with income at below $50,000, expected or thought that there might be some taxpayers who might take small amounts of this. And what we're seeing from the preliminary information is that for the most part, taxpayers didn't take advantage of this if their income was less than $100,000. But there was, the impact was greater at the top end. For those filers with over $500,000 of income, the estimated impact back in 13 was about 45% of the total. That's the 40 million divided by 91. In actuality, the impact was about $8 million more, and so it was about 75% of the total. So the impact was actually much more top-heavy than projected back in 2013. And that can be shown right here also. This mean impact projected back in 2013 was about $1,200, and what we're seeing actually is it's closer to $5,000. And that's a combination of the two factors, is that at the high end, the use is heavier than projected, and at the lower end, there wasn't much use. So taken together, that explains the large difference in the mean impact. The other significant factor here is the number of claimants. So for tax year 2015, we're looking at about 1.7 million tax returns, and about 13,000 of them took advantage of this policy. So that's just under 1%. But for that highest income group, above $500,000, of the 12,000 returns, 3,000 of them claimed it. So about 26% of the high-income filers were able to take advantage of this policy. And again, there were taxpayers down at the other end with income below 50,000. There were 293 of them that did take advantage of the policy. The revenue impact is fairly small for those filers.
Chris, how confident are you then of those numbers going out, 17, 19? 1921, do those still hold?
They, Chair Haas, right now these impacts aren't, I'm not trying to avoid it, they're not inconsistent with that impact. On the one hand, would probably lower the impact because of what we're seeing here. We'll wait to see how 2015 plays out. There is the unknown of the taxpayers we've heard from who would have claimed it had they known. And now there's more, under a current law scenario, now that there's more publicity and understanding of the policy, that might push that revenue impact up. So I don't see right now increasing the impact for those reasons. It might lower it a little bit. But I also have one of my charts later on is a forecast from OEA of Schedule E income, and it shows the differences in those forecasts. And that would be an argument for pushing it up a little bit, possibly. And I'll get to that a little bit more.
So with this chart, it seems clear that we are not helping the lower income people much at all with this policy, and we're helping high income earners significantly.
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, that would be consistent with the figures here that characterizes that. I mean, that, and that's where most of this income is. The higher income filers tend to have more of this income than the low income filers. Mm-hmm. And it can change from year to year depending on whether a given business is having a good year or a bad year. But in aggregate, generally speaking, from year to year, this income is concentrated among the higher income filers. An example of that is here in 2015, we're seeing about 12,000 filers, full year filers with income above $500,000. Back in 2013, the projection for this number of filers was about 9,000 instead of 12,000. So that's another aspect to the forecast, is where taxpayers fall in this income distribution. And that's often driven by larger economic trends. And you get that baseline every quarterly with OEA. And all of the projections we make can be adjusted according to those baseline adjustments.
Thank you.
My perception is, though, that the lower income filers may not even bother with this, simply because it's, why pay the accountant to do another calculation? Might not even pencil out. And that could be one reason that we're not seeing the bottom end taking advantage of this.
Senator Haas, Chair Barkshire, or Chair Haas, Senator Barkshire. That's correct. And I have a slide here that shows the distribution of the impact and how that ranges. And you can see it is concentrated. And if a taxpayer thinks it's only going to be a couple hundred dollars, it may not be worth the time. And so this is that tax cut or tax reduction distribution in $5,000 increments. So we can see that 74% of the tax cut, 74% of the claimants with the tax cut had a tax reduction of less than $5,000. So in total, we have the 13,000 claimants, about 10,000 of them, their tax cut was less than $5,000, and that amounted to $14.5 million of the total tax cut, which was about 21% of the total. And we can see how that distribution drops off pretty quickly. It does cap here in the $75,000 to $80,000 group, because the maximum tax cut a taxpayer can get from this is about $76,000. And again, that gets back to, once the non-passive income hits $5 million, then the tax rates are the same. So there is a cap to that tax cut. And so the 36 here are probably right around that cap, if not at that cap. So by inference, that means they had at least $5 million of this non-passive income. And I tried to put this in a chart, but it just didn't really work because of the shape of it. It disappears pretty quickly. And here's a chart sent over from research there. We're trying to think about ways to convey this. And so here's a graphical representation of that. And the blue line is what's labeled the normal tax. This is that income. The non-passive income goes from zero to $1 million here. And the normal tax is simply 9.9% of that. It assumes they're in the top bracket, and they would pay 9.9% of that tax. The PTE tax, the pass-through Schedule E tax, is this orange line and shows how their tax rate gets lowered from the blue line to the orange line. And the tax reduction is represented by the green line and increases until we get to about $5 million of income, and then it stays flat. It's just another way of conveying that cap. And so here's the Schedule E income forecast, getting back to your question, Chair Haas. The blue line is OEA's forecast for Schedule E income. So this is all Schedule E income, not just the non-passive income. That's too embedded in the data for them to forecast. So back in October of 2013, when the policy was enacted, those forecasts were based on this blue line. And that's what we expected, or that was the projection for Schedule E income moving forward, basically at about $6 billion a year, relatively flat over time. As OEA has modified their forecast in the 2 years since, they have increased the Schedule E income forecast to this orange line. It's basically about a 25% increase from about $6 billion to just under $8 billion over time. So as we look at understanding the policy impact that we have now, the impact that I showed there before about the $200 million to $300 million, I'd be looking at these factors together to see if there'd be a change to that projection. And that would also be the situation for any policy that would adjust for any bill or legislation that would adjust the policy, that we'd be in this situation where we're trying to figure out if the baseline needs to be modified at this point to figure out what the revenue impact would be. And so that drives it. And then we pay attention to this. And, of course, OEA, in their forecast, they're kind of doing the same process where they took the revenue impacts and factored in what that might do to this income, and over time they've made those adjustments, and they'll be considering this new information as well and how that factors into the baseline forecast. And here are some impacts by county. We see that every county except for three had some number of taxpayers claiming using this policy. And Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler had a small number of claimants, so they may not have had any people take advantage of the policy. And for the most part, it was about 0.5% to 1% of the filers in any given county that took advantage of it. The one county that stands out from that is Wallawa County, where we had just over 2% of the filers take advantage of the policy. The bulk of the impact was in the Portland.
Okay, in Wallawa County. How did they find out and nobody else did?
Some rich doctors over there have land.
Since I have a ranch there, I don't think it's that one, okay?
The bulk of the impact is in the Portland area. We have Multnomah County at just under $13 million, Clackamas County at about $12 million, and Washington at $9 million. And then another notable county in terms of magnitude is Lane County at about $8 million. So we did see a number of taxpayers throughout the state being able to take advantage of the policy. So the last slide here is future policy adjustments that are in statute. And this gets back, this is a little, I don't know if it's unprecedented, but it's certainly not common. Given the estimation nature and the data manipulation that we had to go through in 2013 to try and provide you with as accurate estimates as we could on the tax rates, there are two policy or rate adjustments that are built into the statute, that are in statute. And the first one would occur by July 1, 2018, and LRO is tasked with this, to basically look at the actual impacts for tax years 2015 and 2016. So we're talking about doing this in early 18. And comparing the actual tax impact in 2015-16 to the estimated impact in 2015 to 2016. And if the actual impact exceeds, it was larger than the estimated, then basically by more than 15%, then the rates get changed proportionally. The rates would be increased so that that difference would shrink from the greater than 15% down to about 5%. So that policy adjustment basically, if the revenue impact was too large, the rates would increase. And those new rates would be applicable beginning with tax year 2019. And then there is a second potential rate adjustment in statute, and this one would be done by July 1, 2022, and would, again, repeat that exercise where the estimates for 2019 and 2020 would be compared to the actual revenue impact for 2019 and 2020. In this case, it could go either way. If the difference is greater or less than the estimated by 25%, then the rates could be adjusted upward or downward so that the difference would be closer to the estimated. Here, the band, if the difference was greater than 25%, it would be reduced to about 15%. And if the impact were smaller than the actual, then the rates could be reduced. So to try and the goal of this is to get the revenue impacts in line with the projections, which are basically the expectations of the legislature in terms of what this policy would cost. So in my time, this is a little unusual, so I just mentioned it here in terms of policy that is in current statute about adjustments to the tax rate structure for this income. And that's all I had.
Okay. To put this in perspective, I suppose we should have started with this, but we did have in October a panel of CPAs who spoke anecdotally about their own clients who were dentists or surgeons or lawyers who were very pleased to find out about this and took advantage of it, but they didn't hire anyone or create new jobs. So they offered different
different alternative scenarios, from repealing it to changing this and that, and allowing it to be amended. And also the governor's proposed budget, which is a balanced budget, but balanced because it's predicated on a couple things. One of them is the repeal of this. So that's kind of the backdrop here. One thing that we've talked about as on the committee is a tougher requirement or more of a requirement to tie in it to jobs or creating more jobs. And I guess, Chris, that'd be the question. How could we structure that if we said, okay, if you want to take advantage of this, you have to have hire five more people this year or whatever language would look like? We do have legislation or placeholder legislation.
2323.
Yeah. Well, part of that, Chair Haas, would, just thinking off the top of my head, would be requirements for collecting more information and at the taxpayer level, some sort of baseline for their history or in a base year of how many employees they have, and then whether or not they hire more people over time as a result of this. And that factors in. It's helpful to think about the size of the impact. You have some taxpayers whose tax cut is less than $5,000, and it goes up to about $75,000. So part of the argument for that in the past was taking this tax cut and reinvesting it in the business. So there is a time element. For this approach, if the desire is some sort of job creation requirement, with something like this, it would arguably kind of follow after the fact. So they experience this income, they have, say, $75,000 in lower taxes, then that gets reinvested in the business. Maybe that goes to exactly to hire somebody, or maybe it leads to some other capital investment that could lead to job growth. So there's a time element that we would want to consider as well.
Senator Roquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember if Chris was there when we discussed this, but the purpose of the 2015-2016 was to establish first the base year, and then hopefully with the new LRO or the new Department of DOR computer system, we'd have more analytical tools. And correct me, Mr. Warner or Chris, if I'm mistaken here, you know, with those analytical tools, if they reinvest into their business, at least in the S-corps and the partnership filings in the second year, we should be able to do an analyze at least some of the larger incorporations or S-corps or to identify whether they reinvested money in those, whether they expanded, and likewise because of tax filing data, whether their employee costs increase. I appreciate the chair's observation that, you know, what bumper boards can be put on, because contrary to popular belief that this will just, you know, become the pie in the sky and skyrocket out, there were bumper boards up and down placed in this, so if it didn't meet the forecast that we put them back, because once again the goal was trying to get those people actively involved in their businesses to reinvest their money in Oregon, which is why we had 15 and 16 both years, so we could compare those, and hopefully DRR's new computer system will be able to dig deep enough into the tax filing returns, which do have this data in them.
I think, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, I think to that point, that all of that starts with data collection. And we talk and stress, we bring up this point and we stress it to everybody we can, the importance of collecting the data. It's not, it's arguably not sufficient, and the legislature is not interested, not that I can speak for the legislature, but in passing a policy and then just walking away, mm-hmm. saying, okay, we did that, good and done. So anytime a policy gets passed, it is incumbent, I think, upon all stakeholders to look for data collection and where that can be had, whether it's the Department of Revenue or the Employment Department or Business Oregon. So having anything, that's something we just want to keep in mind for all stakeholders, that I'm not a believer in a magical computer system that can get these results. We need the data, and the analytics is a process to get this information. So the data is the starting point for all of that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, because I do file with these, and if my CPA came and said some of these, I would have fired them and filed a complaint against them with their board. But having said that, the present tax filing for a partnership or a S corporation at this point in time in their federal returns and in that data if we can reach in with our computer system, that basic data exists. Now, you can't do it for, you know, 10,000 filings, but you can go in, as we'd said before in this whole discussions of the grand bargain, Mr. Chair, is that in year two, we ought to be able to go into the new computer system and look at those lines and say, from 15 to 16, did their capital investment increase? Did the equity increase? Those are all filings on the partnership return and on the S-corps. Now, unfortunately, the lower end there, it's not there, and there were many of us that were willing to not give this to lawyers, but we lost out. So I believe Chris is right. The question, the deal is, though, is we have some of the baseline data that we could use to make a determination at the end of next year to figure out, okay, did they reinvest this money, or did they go buy a new ski resort or a ski chalet or build a new house in, you know, Bend or whatever it is, and then say, hey, this isn't what we intended. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm off my soapbox.
That's okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Chris. We're going to, our all-star panel of economists are in the building. We're going to take a 5-minute break and then come back. Senate Revenue Committee is back in session. We have a panel of all-star economists here. Paul, perhaps you could introduce them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you recall, a couple of weeks ago, we had the baseline forecast from Office of Economic Analysis. Their forecasts have been tracking pretty well, and we've been right around trend. But one of the things that we like to emphasize, you know, as you're making policy decisions for 17-19, you've got a long period out there. You've got 2.5-year period, so a lot can happen. So what we thought we would do is ask a panel of economists who spent a lot of time thinking and looking at the macro economy and its implications for Oregon and what those risks might be. And so we've asked them to come in and address the, some of their issues that they see as potential risks over that period. We've asked Tim Dewey from University of Oregon on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, Andrew Dykes from Echo Northwest, and Bill Connerly is from Connerly Consulting. Bill was on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors in 1989 when I first came here as state economist. So Bill has been observing the state economy for a long time.
Thank you, gentlemen.
So I think I'm going to lead off. Thank you very much for having me here. Appreciate it. Topic of the day is obviously risk to the Oregon economic forecast. The Office of Economic Analysis recently released a new forecast, and it's become certainly all that more important given the budget deficit facing the state in this upcoming biennium. I think that the forecast...
Tim, can we get you to give your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Tim Dewey, University of Oregon.
Thanks.
I'm going to start by saying that the Office of Economic Analysis, I think, put together a very well-considered and forecast that's really could be reasonably considered the best forecast given our available information. But we all know what happens to the best-laid plans of mice and men. It's not really what we know. It's what we don't know that becomes really problematic for the outlook. And the risk of the unknown is very hard to quantify. With respect to the next biennium, what I'm really looking at is the risk to the U.S. economy, both positive and negative. So my good news is that I don't see the types of imbalances in the U.S. economy of the sort that preceded the last two recessions. So here we're thinking the stock market bubble and the housing market bubble. I don't think we have those kinds of phenomenon on the books quite yet. And so I see the near-term risk of recession is very low. In the office of, in the forecast, it's reported that some firms are looking at a 20% risk of a recession this year. I would say that's very high to me. I think you're looking at more like 5 to 10% that the upcoming year is most likely to be one of expansion. In my opinion, the U.S. economy is just now reaching the point where we're starting to sow the seeds for the next recession. This expansion is 7 years old now, and we're just starting to get near full employment in the economy. The healing, the damage wrought by the popping of the housing bubble has been a very long and arduous process. So I think that we're seeing a lot of evidence the U.S. economy is near full employment. And why is that important? Well, usually when you get to near full employment, The Federal Reserve starts raising interest rates as they want to rein in economic activity, and I think that there's some risk here that we could see them accelerate the pace of that risk, those rates. It looks like to me that a pickup in growth in the near term is actually a fairly likely outcome. I think we've seen evidence in the final part of 2016 that the inventory correction we saw over the past year as a result of the oil drilling collapse and the stronger dollar is starting to come to an end. And we saw in the third quarter 3.2% growth. And in, if we look at gross domestic income, which some people think is a better measure of economic output, we're looking at 5.2% growth rate. Those are fairly strong growth rates as we leave the year. Also, I think, you know, we're seeing some signs that maybe as election uncertainty has ended, that we're seeing firms maybe revisit investment plans and hiring plans. So I think, you're looking at the prospect of some stronger activity right now. Along the scenario, I'd also anticipate a rising value of the dollar and increase in the U.S. trade deficit. And firms in Oregon that are exposed to international competition might be impacted as a result. Now, we also have this additional uncertainty in the form of proposed increases of fiscal stimulus, looking at tax cuts and spending increases possibly. We really don't know the dimensions of any such fiscal stimulus at this point. All we can really say is that previous Republican administrations have generated substantial deficit spending, and I would expect it to be fairly likely this time as well. It's a very unusual time for expansionary fiscal policy. With the economy at full employment, this could push forward more inflationary-type consequences for the economy, and I think would tend to cause the Federal Reserve to lift interest rates at a more rapid pace. So I think when I look at these risks, I think the near-term risks are probably weighted somewhat to the upside. A change in the pace of activity would likely prompt the Federal Reserve to increase rates at a faster pace. And is that necessarily a bad thing? No, but I think you're starting to set the stage for a recession sometime more like 2019. It's very typical that, you know, in a business cycle such as we're experiencing, that, you know, that once the Fed starts raising rates, they continue to raise rates, they over tighten policy, and oftentimes thereafter you'll end up with a recession. We have had soft landings in the past, and maybe the Fed will be lucky this time as well. So by my analysis, though, that really makes that the 2019-2021 biennium much more at risk of a shortfall relative to the current biennium. You know, there's certainly a lot of uncertainty, though, particularly on the downside. You know, we've seen a presidential candidate with considerably, I'd say, disjointed rhetoric. We don't really know what policies are going to emerge from this administration. We could see significant disruptions to our international trade partners, a dramatic change to the Affordable Care Act, a shift in staffing at the Federal Reserve to a more aggressive policy stance. All of those things could happen, and in those cases sort of accelerate the timeline of any downturn. But I would say that regardless of what timing of the next recession, I think we're getting to the point where we do have to think about our long-term fiscal issues. Acting now would be painful, but certainly acting during a recession even more so. My expectations, so in summary, I believe the near-term risks of the Oregon economy are balanced somewhat to the upside for the very near term, but I think that, you know, looking at a little bit farther out, we do have to consider that a recession would be a real possibility in that next biennium. I haven't seen the conditions yet, the 7 years, to say confidently that I could say, we're looking at a time period where a recession, is more likely, and I think I'm just starting to see that going forward. It's very difficult, though, to incorporate such predictions into a forecast. You're still 2 years out, and there is considerable uncertainty surrounding any type of forecast. My bottom line, though, is that if I'm correct and there's a higher probability of a recession in the next biennium, then we're coming close to losing our opportunity to, I think, stabilize the best budget over the longer run. This biennium could be our last chance for another several years. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm Andrew Dyke of Echo Northwest, for the record. And I think I'll end up echoing a lot of what Professor Dewey was saying in terms of the relative risks. And I wanted to sort of divide my comments into a couple of areas. One, starting from the national level, and the punchline there is, again, right now, don't see any reason to think there's a significant risk of a downturn in the near term, say, next 12 to 18 months. So dive into that a little bit. There are a lot of unknowns that have yet to be quantified, and want to walk you through some of those. And then spend a little bit of time thinking about Oregon-specific conditions, because clearly, you know, as a relatively small state, what the Oregon economy is going to respond to national, international conditions very strongly. And, you know, we can't drive the national economy, but there are, you know, sort of policy actions that, you know, can have more or less positive impacts. And I think the sort of the fiscal stress that we're seeing right now, in despite the, you know, relatively long-running, if slow, economic expansion is evidence of that. So stepping back to the national level, again, as has already been mentioned, you know, we're approaching 90 months of an economic recovery, one of the longest on record. I think, you know, if we were predicting earthquakes, you know, that's all we have to look at. Cascadia subduction zone quake is overdue, and that's the best we can say. In economics, we have a lot more to work with, and I'd look more to economic fundamentals than just to longevity of the recovery. And, again, all the indicators seem to be pointing upward nationally. Employment continues to grow, likely to grow at a slower pace in the coming months and years, as, you know, the OEA analysis indicates, forecast indicates. So those things look good. Again, the indicators moving in the right direction. But important to consider the risk of a probability, and no model is perfect. It's very difficult to predict recessions. But looking to the economic fundamentals, one of the models we've been using for our public and private sector clients is called Nexus Bond Premium Model. And the idea there is it looks at the markets for corporate bonds and looks at the spread or the excess spread between what you would expect interest rates to be for those corporate bonds based on the industry, the structure of the bond, the default risk, et cetera, and finding the residual there. And when there's a large so-called excess bond premium, that tends to predict a recession is more likely. Again, not without flaws. Right now, if you look at the excess bond premium modeling, the predicted probability of a recession is under 10%. So very low risk of a probability based on economic fundamentals over the next 12 months or so. Not to say things can't change. If you were to look back a year, we would have been saying the risk is at 50, 55% risk of a recession. That's not guaranteed. We didn't see one. We've seen conditions in the domestic and international financial markets settle down quite a bit. Here we are again looking forward. Relatively little reason to concern right now about a recession in the near term. Ask me again in a few months. Who knows? We have a new administration coming in. Lots of policy unknowns there, and conditions can change. In terms of risk, you know, I'd look to a few different areas, and they're up here. One would be the high debt-to-GDP ratio. For the country, we're at a debt of over 100% of the GDP, the annual domestic output of the country. This is likely to create a drag and has created some drag on the economy. There's academic debate that's legitimate about the size of that effect, whether there are specific thresholds beyond which you should not go for risk of creating recession, but some negative impact. And depending on how the new administration's investments, tax policy play out, we may see that that ratio increase. Creating sort of a chronic headwind on the economy, not necessarily driving anybody into a recession, but creating the possibility of longer-term, you know, tendency towards stagnation as opposed to explosive growth. Another area I'd look to is trade policy. You know, a lot of unknowns, a lot of statements have been made in terms of what might be implemented in terms of, you know, these one-off firm to federal government deals. I think, you know, the markets are pretty resilient in the absence of, you know, political concern over that type of approach. That's not likely to drive significant change. Of much more concern, clearly, would be more protectionist trade policies, you know, implementation of high tariffs on whether it's domestic firms that leave or, you know, foreign imports. That's a clear problem. No one wins from there. So a lot of uncertainty there. And then finally, to the infrastructure investments, we don't really know what the plan will look like. Certainly, infrastructure spending can create near-term stimulus in terms of spending. I think broad consensus that both in the, within the state and across the country, there's a need for more infrastructure investment. How that plays out has a very important role in what benefits we'll see. Poorly selected projects can lead to maybe near-term stimulus, but longer-term waste, increasing debt without providing real benefits. Think sort of bridges to nowhere versus fixing potholes. So the nature of the projects that are selected will determine what kinds of economic benefits we realize over the longer term. In addition, the financing of the projects is important as well. And one of the areas we look at a lot within my firm for a variety of clients is sort of congestion prices, tolling, user-paid, user fees that can support investments in infrastructure. And whether that's viable for any specific project is obviously an open question. But I think a focus on sort of, charging in some sense the beneficiaries of investments provides an important lens that focuses attention on assessing the viability and economic value of specific investments. So again, yet to see how that unfolds. But by and large, summary: I don't see great risk of recession over the near term, but plenty of uncertainty out there. Turning to the state conditions in the state, as you're all aware and as laid out in the OEA forecast and analysis, the recovery in Oregon has been in some areas and time during some time periods, near the top of the performance if you look at across states, across the nation as a whole, but with significant geographic disparities in how the benefits have unfolded. A lot of rural counties are still struggling to achieve the employment levels, the economic activity that they had prior to the recession and maybe even rolling back into the 90s and prior decades. That's a real problem. That's a risk. I think if nothing else, we've seen through the last election cycle within the state and across the country how at a minimum this is, damages political discourse and the ability to push policy forward. Ultimately, there are likely to be economic risks as well. So that's one area I'd look to. No really obvious broad-based opportunities for economic development for these more rural areas, but something that, I think we need to spend a lot of time and energy trying to address. Secondly, we want to think about, again, the sort of longer-term implications of policy. We have, maybe slow and steady, but within Oregon overall, relatively strong recovery. Nonetheless, we're looking at a lot of fiscal stress. The legislative session is going to spend a lot of time trying to address that. A lot of factors that maybe at the beginning of the various policies, PERS, et cetera, no one knew the full outcomes. But we've seen a lot of these problems coming. We're close to, I hate to use the word crisis, but crisis mode, if nothing else. And what I think is maybe a greater risk to the state of Oregon's economy right now is that the policy that's enacted to address these issues is hasty and doesn't fully consider the long-term behavioral reaction of economic actors. We know that economic incentives matter. We know that individuals, households, businesses respond to economic incentives. It's a truism that is true. Price goes up, demand goes down. Hard to find compelling evidence that doesn't happen. And again, looking back to the last election, I think we've seen, on both sides of most issues, both locally and nationally, a lot of wishful thinking, wishing that people did not behave in rational economic ways. They tend to, on average, for the most part. And so I think a big risk is that we implement policy without fully considering the longer-term costs in the interest of solving sort of near-term fiscal crisis. Thank you.
Good morning. I am Bill Connerly, economist and business consultant, and also chairman of the board of Cascade Policy Institute. Plutarch tells us about a meeting between Solon, who codified the Athenian law, and Croesus, the very rich king. And Croesus said, look at my riches. Am I not the happiest man in the world? And Solon said, that is best judged at the end of one's life, and the future is uncertain. So 2,500 years later, the future is still uncertain. And it's a fact, and my colleagues have discussed some of the major uncertainties. I'd like to add, in addition to the risk of a national recession, which worries me, the potential for a change in the economy that affects Oregon disproportionately worse. In the 2001 recession, that recession nationally is considered to be one that was relatively mild, but in Oregon it was relatively severe because of the emphasis on tech. And a change in the economy that skewers the high-tech sector would be particularly harsh on Oregon. A change in the economy that focuses on international trade, and especially trade with China and other Asian countries, would be especially harsh for Oregon. So the folks in Washington, D.C. might look at a change and say, oh, fairly small, we can handle it. But depending on the change, it could be particularly difficult for those of us in Oregon. And in addition to recession, we have policies of the new president. And I don't know what they are, but some of them could be negative for our budget, such as through support for Medicaid activities. When I was a young economist, as my colleagues are, I spoke with confidence. As I have aged, I have emphasized those uncertainties more, and recently wrote a book for my business colleagues, talking about how to deal with uncertainty. The subtitle is like, how do you run an organization if you don't trust the economist's forecasts? And I'd like to share with you the lessons I'm learning from business leaders around the country about dealing with an uncertain environment. And first, let me preface that by saying uncertainty is not only about the economy, it's about technological change, social attitudes, government policy, and competition. The first thing that I talk to people about and businesses resonate with is that how you run an organization may increase your flexibility to deal with change or reduce your flexibility. Some simple examples: buying a building compared to renting space. Buying a building, you have less flexibility to expand, contract, or change direction, whereas renting gives you more flexibility, hiring versus contracting out. A variety of everyday program decisions made in this capital affect the ability of the state to fluidly adjust its activities, and I would suggest considering that. That is not strictly a kind of revenue issue, it's more of a program issue, but having that in mind at all times is helpful. The second suggestion, obviously, is build up reserves, and we do have a rainy day fund, an educational stability fund, and the next time you look at those numbers, you might compare them to the alternative economic scenarios in the Office of Economic Analysis forecast. They project revenues under a mild recession and a severe recession, and a mild recession overwhelms the two rainy day funds. The severe recession substantially overwhelms those funds. So one prudent recommendation would be build up more reserves. The third suggestion, and this is probably the most valuable one, is developing a contingency plan for a downside scenario, be it a recession or a particular impact on Oregon industries. I spoke with one Oregonian business leader who was running a title insurance company, and he said over time he realized that the difference between a good year and a bad year can be a 30% drop in revenue. 30% is pretty hefty. So at the beginning of every year, as he planned out his budget, he had two budgets. The primary one was his best estimate of the future. The second budget had a 30% drop in revenue, and he then adjusted his expenses for that. And I would recommend that the legislature look at those alternative economic scenarios, the mild scenario, mild recession scenario and severe recession scenario, and consider what it would do under those scenarios. And one option is to budget, have a base budget for the revenue that you would get under the severe recession scenario, and then have additional add-ons which are implemented when it's clear that the revenue is actually coming in. Doing the thinking ahead of time about these downside contingencies has two advantages. One is speed of response. Speed of response is critical. As I was researching the book, I talked to a number of bankers, and I said, what's the difference between a company that survives a recession and a company that does not survive a recession? And the most common answer was speed of response. Those who respond very quickly to changing economic conditions survive, and those who respond slowly do not survive. A simple arithmetic example is if the legislature needs to cut spending and spreads that cut over 18 months, it's less severe than if it waits and has to spread that over 12 or 6 months. So fast action is valuable. The second benefit of doing the contingency planning in advance is that in a more relaxed atmosphere, plans can be made consistent with one's values and one's strategy. Panic sets in and you tend to forget where you're, I shouldn't say you, some people tend to forget what their core values are and what their long-term strategy is in a panic situation. Thinking through ahead of time the contingency plan allows consistency with one's core values and strategies. And the last piece of advice I'll give is to not only think in terms of a downside contingency plan, but an upside contingency plan. What do we do if things turn out unusually well? For things that are above forecast within a biennium, we have a contingency plan called the kicker. But consider the possibility of a biennium which is, before we start there, looking pretty good. And revenues are strong. Okay, maybe you can't relate to that right now. But in a time when revenues are strong, it can be dangerous to implement new programs ongoing because the revenue may not always be there. So in addition to the downside contingency plan, a little time, I suggest, be contributed to an upside contingency plan. Those are my suggestions. I know this is not an easy time to be working on budgets, but I just need to say it could get a lot worse.
Thank you for those very candid comments. It's a lot to chew on, Senator Riley.
Thank you. One of the first things you talked about was putting more money in our contingency funds, and I absolutely agree with that. One of the last things you talked about was the kicker.
Yeah.
Those two things are diametrically opposed. And what do you think, how do you think we can deal with that? How can we put more money in the good times when we have to give it back?
Well, Senator Haas and Senator Riley, the kicker has an advantage, and I think we need to understand what the advantage is, first of all. A couple of advantages, but one from a practical standpoint is it prevents the legislature from taking surprisingly strong revenues and starting new programs. If the kicker were to go into a reserve fund, a rainy day fund, I'd be comfortable with that. But I think that the public is concerned about taking sort of good fortune and using that as the down payment on a new car when they don't have the revenue for ongoing payments. But that's one reasonable solution.
Senator Boquist.
I appreciate your candor. And I'm probably going to bet the good doctor here, which is two or one, who's going to be right here. But having said that, I just remind the five old white men sitting here that we put forth a plan to expand the reserve fund and solutions of that. and we actually managed to get the thing back out of the house on our own floor, killed it right in front of us, shot the dog in front of us, and we'd be in a better financial position than we're right now. But I too, like Senator Riley, I'm not sure, since our own colleagues have not been supportive of our efforts on a reserve fund, I would only encourage you to somehow get a meeting with co-chairs, because half of what you said they ought to hear, not us. But you're right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bartsugger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this question, hopefully each one of you will answer this question freely. Does a 20,000 stock market concern you?
Excuse me, does it what?
A 20,000 stock market concern
you? Jones.
Does it concern me?
Yes.
I'd be happy with it for my own 401k. I'm not worried about the prospects of the market going up. One of the things to keep in mind is so much of our revenue in the state comes from capital gains triggered by stock market changes nobody can forecast the stock market, and yet our revenues depend on what the stock market does. So that just sort of reemphasizes the rolling of the dice issue.
Yeah, my second, I guess, vote for not being terribly concerned in and of itself, and I look to the, look for evidence of bubbles, look at economic fundamentals, and, you know, as you heard, I think all three of us say over the near term anyway, not seeing great reason for concern, not to say something couldn't happen that would result in a correction, but not seeing a great risk of that right now, and I think... was just alluded to that I may feel differently about that if I'm starting to invest in my 401k, putting together some, state plans on something versus nearing retirement and needing more certainty of a stream of income. But I'd say, for these purposes, as of right now, I'm not particularly concerned. I think, a lot of people were surprised that the markets reacted so favorably to the election outcomes. Some bounce there, whether that's completely warranted or not, I will leave as an unanswered question at this point.
I'm not concerned either. I think you could also add the possibility that it's discounting the possibility of faster near-term growth as, I think is a risk this forecast. And so it could just be that as well. The stock market will likely go down when we have the next recession, and that's when I would be more worried about it.
Well, the Dow Jones is at 19,769 right now, up 12. So I don't know if you want to modify your answers. We really thank you for coming down here today and giving us your presentation. We have our quarterly forecast, but hearing it from you guys who are out there in the real world is good for us, too. So we appreciate it very much. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. It's time for the work group update on nonprofit property.
Kyle up here.
We'll start with Kyle.
Two of the distinguished members.
We have our two members up here.
I don't know that we're distinguished.
No, you're distinguished.
Yeah, we've distinguished that we know less than we thought we knew. That's distinguished. We've been at this a long time.
But I want to see what Kyle thinks we know.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to give a little bit of an update on some interim work that's been ongoing for the better part of the last year. And I do have a document up in OLIS that I won't really refer to too much. It's largely a compilation of the things I've discussed in front of this committee in the past, because I think the third update now. But so the work group, there's almost two parts of it. We have a paper that LRO is putting together. That's a background document that's been useful as the work group, the legislative work group, has been ongoing. But we'll have that available at the start of the 17 session. But again, the topic that the work group has been looking into is the exemption and taxation of nonprofits. And this is on the property tax side, so it'd be the nonprofit-owned or leased property. And there's emphasis upon the literary, charitable, and scientific organizations exemption, which is the one under 307-130, ORS 307-130, and that's what the LRO paper will focus on. But again, the topic of the work group has been all the exemptions, for sure. And so, things to step through. I guess I would call attention to, we do have at this point some legislative concepts that have been introduced or will be introduced this afternoon in the House Revenue Committee as well, with the traditional disclaimer that these are concepts. I don't think they represent the end result or anything at this point. But we have one here in the Senate Finance and Revenue. It's LC 3161, and it's related to doing an annual information return, is what the concept's hitting on for nonprofits that are receiving or seeking to receive the exemption. So you can see the language is up there under the meeting materials. And then we have two concepts that will be on the House revenue side that are LC 954 and LC 2286. 954 relates to how health clinics could qualify for exemption, how that would work. And then 2286 is it's a concept that would direct LRO to study nonprofit exemptions. So if you don't approve of our report in February, you can pass it along, make us do it again. but it also has a nice relating to clause, so it's really there for if something comes up and needs to be adjusted. But again, so those are up on OLIS now. And then the last thing I have up in the document on OLIS is just a listing of the nonprofit exemptions that are on the books today, and then with the revenue loss impacts that are estimated in the governor's tax expenditure report, and you heard from DOR this morning, so it's updated with those new estimates that of the report that just got published. But so that's the quick overview of what we have.
One of the I think the thing that got us started on this, for good or bad, was discretion of property tax assessors, that there were no bright lines, and Senator Boquist Museum treated differently than a museum in another county. Will there be concepts that will give more guidance to assessors on property taxes? Senator Boquist?
Yeah. You're absolutely, Chair Hass, you're absolutely correct. And I think Senator Riley can jump in here too. And what we've been working with the assessors and pressing on them is to, you know, what standardization, if we want to standardize and then establish bright lines, what might they look like? What are those? One of the challenges the assessors have pointed out to you, which one of these LC concepts tries to address, is that unless they find out about it, they don't know what it is, and then they go look at it, and then it starts down this really gray area of where does it fall under the law. And so what we don't have is a clear, if you're, for example, a nonprofit, if you're the cat ranch in Yamhill County, is you know, what, you know, even though you get this property tax exemption, in this case it lost it, we don't have data on it. We don't have data on the horse ranch next to it to say this is getting, you know, a nonprofit, so it doesn't pay it. And it's, once again, we're back where we are with DOR, and we're talking about before, is we lack the information. Now, the assessors are recircling after 8 months of discussion, and we're trying to say, okay, look, what is the information you need to start standardizing so that we can see what the bright lines are and going down with it? Because, I mean, what we've learned is what we don't know in this, and that is that each type of exemption is slightly different, as we all knew here. And so what we started out in and thinking might be slightly easier is probably going to be a slightly more long-term project. I don't think that LRO is trying to put together what we've talked about right now, which will be discussed much by outside people when they see it. But once again, I don't think we've come to any conclusions whatsoever. The biggest challenge is you know, just how do you get a definition of either six or seven items so that we can get everybody on the same sheet of music of what it looks like? Kyle has been doing an exceptional job, and we've gone back, and the assessors have recommitted to try and say, you know, this is really the information we need to be able to try and establish what bright lines are that are out there. We've unfortunately focused probably more on some of the 800-pound gorillas, only because they're the biggest entities. And that's only from example purposes. It's not like picking on hospitals or medical clinics. It's just the one we have the most data for to be able to look at how does the process work. It is a quagmire, and I think Representative Langer probably has the best. We will chip away at the edge of the eight-sided dome here, maybe with one chip this session, and try and start down the road. But I will bluntly say, and then let Chuck talk,
this is going to take us probably a year or two more to figure out where it is we can even go.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, one of the biggest problem is the variety of charitable institutions, calling that, and trying to figure out if they really are charitable institutions is part of the issue.
Yeah.
When we have a range of nonprofits from, as he pointed out, a cat farm to a hospital, these are amazingly different things with different needs and different amounts of actual charity. Just because a federal government grants a 501c3 doesn't mean much of anything. It simply means that someone asked for it and they said yes, because they don't do any investigation. They just say, oh yeah, this sounds good. Yes, you get it. And so, one of the things I want to look at and it is to try to figure out a method for saying, are these really charitable institutions? And it's very difficult. It's almost individual how you would say, is it or is it not? If you like cats a lot, you might think a cat farm is a charitable institution, even though this particular one turns out probably not to be.
So if your assessor is a cat person,
let him have it. Yeah. And so exactly. And so, you know, judging whether something should have a tax exemption and how much of a tax exemption becomes almost personal. And that's the issue. It's a problem.
That's right. That's what we want to take out.
Exactly. That's what we want to get rid of. And again, it's a real challenge. And I think when he said it's take us another year to 18 months, I think he's being generous. that we've been working on this for how many years now to try to make it as bad as it is, and to change that to make it good again is going to take just as long.
And I think our goal is information at this point, Mr. Chair, is that if we can come up something in this session that says, okay, at least let's get all the information to the assessors, and in what we're trying to do is address not new reporting, but there's existing data out there that our agencies don't share amongst themselves, and some is at the state level and some is at the county level, is if we can come up with a mechanism in which, the data gets at least to the assessors so that they have it in their file, because everybody has a file whether an assessment has been done or not. And then we're in a position to be able to say, okay, here's the number of entities we're talking about, here's the parameters, yes, they file a C-12, for those of you who don't know what a C-12 is, it's a nonprofit report with the state. Yes, they file a 990-PF. Or even if they don't file a 990-PF, it's like, we're nonprofit, we're exempt, we filed our 990-PF. It is amazing that we have found in some of these documentations that, you have people that are rather large nonprofits and they've just kind of like ignored that filing requirement with the state of Oregon for eons. And so that material is not available, and we're giving them a property tax deduction based on that filing. It's just trying to identify to get that data going in front of us.
Well, I still think it feels like progress. It's a little Rumsfeldian to say we don't know. We now know what we don't know, but I think that's progress.
Good, right.
So thanks both of you. I know it's been a slog to go through this, and to Reps Benz and Leininger and Kyle. We're making progress. We're moving forward, and we'll continue. So thanks to all of you. All right, so that brings us to the end of our agenda. We're a little bit ahead of time, and this will be our last interim committee. So thank you all, and we want to bid a fond farewell to one of our team members, Senator Edwards, moving on to other things, the University of Oregon. So thank you for helping us on this committee and creating a coveted vacancy on this committee now.
Really? You think somebody wants that chair?
Yeah. All right, everyone.
Thanks. We are adjourned. Adjourned. Thanks. We are.